onto Mane, and Liverpool lead.
The Premier League is back, and Off the Ball is the only place you can hear live commentary of Liverpool's march to the title, the battle for the Champions League places, and the fight for survival. Every big game exclusively live between now and the end of the season, starting this Wednesday from 7 p.m. with Manchester City against Arsenal. Yeah! And we'll also have live score updates on the OTB Sports app. OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the OTB Sports app.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.
Now, something a bit different for you this evening on Monday Night Rugby. Obviously, there's not much rugby to discuss. New Zealand aside over the weekend. So we have nagged our following guest to come on and talk to us about his career, his thoughts on the game, and wherever we stumble really is the plan. So very happy to say you will all know him through his work at Sky over the many years and before that with Bath in England. We have Stuart Barnes with us. Stuart, how are you doing? Great to have you with us, I must say.
Thank you very much, Joe. Good to be with you. Sun's shining in England, so we're smiling.
Where in England have you made your home?
West Country. I was sort of a bit homeless for a while. I started in a sort of move with a family to South Wales, went to university and then sort of joined Bristol. And from there on, sort of the last 35 years, I've been West Country. But there's a sort of a little bit of Wales, a bit of Essex, a bit of Oxford and a bit of West Country. So no one's quite certain where I'm from.
When I told you we'd be a few minutes late getting to you, you told me that's fine by you, a few extra minutes of Bob Dylan. And I was reading your book as well, Sketches from Memory, and there's plenty of Dylan references across this book as well. So we've got an Uber fan, do we?
No, major. A real Dylan bore. A real Dylan bore, yeah.
What is it about Dylan?
I'm a lyrics man, first and foremost, and I think he's the best songwriter there has been in the last, well, in the history of rock and roll, folk, you name it. And Dylan's ability to reinvent himself. I love the fact that he's been a folk singer. He's been the bête noire of the establishment mid-60s. His country and western. I just played an album of his triplicate where he was crooning and doing his Dylan version of Frank Sinatra. He's been everywhere and done everything, and he's not afraid to try something new. And I think that's a pretty decent way to approach life.
I got the impression from your book where you would throw in references as well as to Bob Dylan, but to everybody from Colm Tobin to Emily Dickinson, that you enjoy your books, you enjoy reading. Talk to us about that, because that's not something you get to talk about across an 80-minute match on Sky Sports. So books, a big part of your life?
Massive. It's a massive part of my professional life. I'm a massive reader of books, a huge amount of fiction, but all sorts, you know, fact as well. And I always think that it's very easy. You could spend your whole life watching rugby matches, talking to rugby coaches, and as you get older, talking to players as well, so you don't get too detached. But there's only that's one angle of approaching sport and life. And I think there's a more interesting way, which is to go via books. And, you know, I could be scurrying through the New York Review of Books and I might just find a quote there. And it sounds pretentious, but I'll just underline it because it's, you know, there's so much that's relevant. Rugby isn't in a box. And my beef with sport, often with its journalism and broadcasting, is that you're categorised that way. And people sort of see writers and broadcasters as someone really who's stuck in a sort of a little box talking about rugby or in a press box writing about it. And I think that it's a great big wide world out there and there are experiences to be drawn from it in terms of literature because, you know, I've travelled the world a million times reading books, but I've been to Australia and New Zealand a lot with rugby, but nothing like reading.
You unpacked that box yesterday in your Sunday Times column. Rugby is due its day of reckoning over both race and class. And you start off by saying, white silence is violence. You'll have seen Logan on placards in Bristol and beyond. And you say, if this is the case, then rugby union has a more violent history off the field than most. And you talk about the three most famous brands. It featured in the most abhorrent of all racist forms, apartheid, the Springboks, the British and Irish Lions, and the All Blacks. And you list out the many tours which have taken place there, post the Gleneagles agreement included,
yep.
English tours. You don't mention the Irish tour of 1981, but that very much...
Well, because I was talking Empire, I thought about this, Joe, and I thought, if I put Ireland in with Empire, I'm going to end up with a few people in your country giving me stick. So I left Ireland and France. I left Ireland and France out of it for that reason.
Right, interesting. Because I know even of the 1981 tour, John Robbie, who's made his life down in South Africa now,
yes. Yeah.
He recently described the 81 tour as a stain that will never leave me. Really weighs heavily on him. So, I mean, it's a fantastic piece. And you do say history cannot be rewritten, but maybe a new and better page can be turned. And you floated the idea of, for instance, Amaro Itoje being Lions captain and the symbolism that would have on the next Lions tour. It's a pretty shameful history, really, isn't it? Those rugby tours to South Africa, they don't sit easily with you, clearly, based on this piece. I know you turned down a tour in your playing days.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great thing when ANC won the election, because I always wanted to see the country, because it had such a history as a rugby nation, but the rugby nation came very much second. So I was very lucky touring in 1984 when apartheid had come to an end. But it's always fascinated me. I've got a few links with Donald Woods, the activist, and I know his son Dylan very well and do some work there. So it's quite close to, well, I nearly said my heart. Some people think I don't have one. But if I have a heart, South Africa would be somewhere there. And I've been there many times since. It's a troubled country. And like all these things, it's not just colour. It is class as well, which I try to put into that piece. And, the whole thing, it does go back to the fact that rugby is an empire sport. Rugby and cricket, they were born out of empire. England, New Zealand, South Africa, Australia with their Aboriginal policies. And I could have included them in the piece as well. But I just felt they weren't quite on the same level of rugby brand as Lions, All Blacks, Springboks. So I left that off there, but there's no doubt at all. Firstly, I would say I would take Maro Itoje, irrespective of colour, white, green, yellow, pink, black, I don't care. He would be my Lions captain, and I've thought that for probably 2 years. But there is, when that is done, there's a very beneficial symbolism involved. And there's a degree of atonement that comes without doing the wrong thing. Not a politically correct decision. I have been someone, I'm of the left, but I have always been wary of political correctness. It unnerves me. But I think that if Itoje had been slightly behind someone else as a contender, I'd have said take him anyway as the captain. I would have bet that way. I think what's happening now, what's been happening the last few years, what's not said, means that perhaps this is an instance where you would have said you take a black man as captain anyway. I think the great thing is, from a Lions perspective, I reckon he's the best captain. He's an extremely articulate man. And I think a shot of him and Siya Kolisi shaking hands before and at the end of the series would be more important than the Lions winning, drawing, or South Africa winning or drawing or losing.
You did touch on class in your piece as well. Give us a sense of rugby and class in the UK today.
Well, I think England in particular. Ireland as well. I mean, there's no doubt at all. You know, Dublin it's not a working class game in Dublin. Never been my sense of it. It's come out of Black Rock and such schools. And I've always, because of my politics, I've always had a sort of a hankering to be on the Munster side of the border, because the sort of traditions, and maybe it's a myth now, I don't know, but I've always felt that Munster, when I was a kid, I was told that old phrase, dockers and the dockers and the doctors. So I took the dockers side there. And it's even in Wales, as a schoolboy there, if there was someone from Millfield came for a Welsh trial, he could be just shot into the team, and he wasn't great. And there's a perception in Wales. Wales is very much, it's a working class country and it's working class sport. To a greater degree, I think, than probably, definitely England, probably Ireland, and definitely Scotland, Wales is more working class, but there's still deference to the public school elite. And again, I think it goes back to empire. And that's why the piece I wrote in yesterday's Sunday Times, yes, it was about colour, but colour has to mix with class. And that's why I talked about Ellis Genge. And so many, you know, England have had a lot of black internationals, but you know, so many of them are Millfield or Harrow. When I was captain of Bath, we signed Stephen Gomo, Bugu, Adedeo, Adebayo. The three of them came from two public schools in Devon, like a job lot. And I always sensed that when you were a black man from a public school coming, there was almost a sense of you'd be accepted straight away because that was sort of part and parcel. And Genge, I think, has been a very feisty character, a very interesting character, because he comes from a tough part of Bristol where, you know, he's working class in extremis, capital W. And he feels that. He feels the working class more than he feels the race thing. And I think that is why they're inextricably linked.
Was Oxford an uncomfortable fit for you in ways?
Yeah, it was. It was. When I was a kid and I couldn't wait to get away from home. I liked a pint even at the age of 18. And that was all very exciting. But, you know, when I went up for interviews, there were people who I thought were professors, tweed suits, sitting there. And I'm thinking, why are they sitting in the interview room? And they weren't. They were public school people from Harrow, Wellington, wherever, and they were being groomed for it. And they were from a different class, a different world to me. And I can recall during the Falklands War getting into trouble because we had an awful lot of Oxford people. I'd done a bit of time in the military. Again, it goes back to the class thing. I remember when the Belgrano was sunk at number 8, my college team raised a glass and saying, here's to the Belgrano going down. And I sort of raised a glass and talked about our ship that had gone down a couple of weeks earlier. And there was a stony silence. And I, you know, to me in that war, it was a tragedy to see British troops dying, equal tragedy to see Argentinians dying. That's how I felt. And Oxford, we keep coming back. Oxford, again, it's part of this whole class empire thing. It was a wonderful place in many ways. And I messed up quite badly. My tutors were magnificent. I'm far more interested in academia in the years when I left there. But I found it overwhelming. I found it class ridden. And I think if I hadn't been a very good rugby player who walked straight in as a key component in the Oxford team, then I'd have found it very hard. And I can recall, I think it might be in the book Sketches from Memory, I recall being with the rugby boys and we'd go down from the junior common room to the place where the state school lads were playing Space Invaders, which was the new thing then. And I'd be with the rugby players, the sort of public school boys, mocking them for their accent. And I still had this goddamn sort of half Welsh accent as well. But I was ashamed of it, and you knew it, but you were scared what to do. A little bit of that bully in there. And like I say, had I been out of it for 3 years, I'd have gone there. I'd have told the public school sector where the hell to go. It only happened sort of when there was a war. Was I just couldn't stand the sort of nationalism. I never liked nationalism and I still don't. Mm-hmm.
And for people who don't know, because I hadn't realised this, so you were an Essex-born Welsh schoolboy prodigy.
Yeah.
Basileg was the school. And I know you played for the Welsh under-15s and I think you even jumped up several grades to the 19s in the space of a year. You did say in Sketches from Memory, too many people told me how good I was. I didn't like to fight in the dirt for it. It was the divine right of Barnes, a touch in title, how you described yourself. So you were very, very talented teenager coming through.
Yeah, I was very hard working as well, which people find quite surprising. But yeah, I worked my arse off, and I was a good sportsman, cricket, football, and I made the decision to go rugby. And you know, I played 4 straight years without missing a game for Welsh schools. And you know, people like Carwin James, the legend, were write pieces for the Western Mail, and you know, he'd say Barnes is the future, and you just got so excited. And you know, you, because Wales is a small rugby country, you'd be in there as a schoolboy all the time, and things came easy, you know. And it would have helped had I been dropped as a 16-year-old from the under 19 thing. Would have helped, but I never was, and you never thought you would. You just thought everything would happen. And you know, I went into, I played my first game for Newport as soon as I could, sort of 18 in a couple of days, and scored a try within a minute. Everything seemed to just go right, you know, too much. You need things to go wrong. I understand that now. And you went, I went to Oxford. Whilst that delayed sort of seriousness of the career, you walked straight into an Oxford University rugby team. It's very different now, you know, lots of international. You were a key component, and just nothing went wrong. And I got capped pretty quickly, though I thought I should have been capped as a 12-year-old probably. And then when I got dropped for Rob Andrew, I couldn't. And instead of thinking, well, how can I make myself undroppable? I sort of watched him play and went, Christ, that was rubbish. He didn't do that very well. And it was a little part of that, I think, went through the international career as well. And you'd say two things there. Because I was entitled as a sportsman as a kid, therefore you couldn't bear losing. That was a problem. And the other problem was English rugby was played a very different way in the early 80s to Welsh. And whilst I was English, I played like a Welshman, and I don't think English selectors understood what I wanted to do. And I sure as hell couldn't see the interest in turning up in a training session and as a fly half, you were practicing kicking the ball dead from 60 metres, because in those days it would be a dropout 25. And you're thinking, if that's all you're doing. So I was entitled. When I shouldn't have been, but that's quite hard not to be, I think. And I was English in terms of my blood when I was Celtic in terms of my outlook on life.
Hmm. You made your England debut in 84. You won 10 caps over the following decade, I suppose. It would always be billed as Rob Andrew's kicking, you know, more structured, that he could run a game better. Is that how you see things, or do you bristle at that characterization?
No. Funnily enough, the thing I bristle at is when I'm called the Cavalier and Rob's the Roundhead. I mean, I couldn't be a Cavalier because I'd have been fighting on the side of the Roundheads, and I suspect Rob, probably from Barnard Castle in Yorkshire, would have been on the side of the other lot. So straight away, that's wrong. And I also bristle. I was a running fly half, but to be a running fly half in England was just to be a maverick. And I hate that word, because a maverick is someone who doesn't assess risk, who can't run a game, who just does things on the blink. It's completely different. I was very well tutored. I was coached well by Welshman at school level. I was very lucky to find my way to Brian Ashton very quickly and Jack Rowell. And yeah, I thought things for myself, but you know, if I was anything, I was a decision maker, you know. And if you looked at players now, I would want to be associated with someone from an Irish perspective, like Ronan O'Gara or Johnny Sexton, because they controlled games. Now, I would say Rob was a better kicker out of hand than I was. There's no doubt about it at all. But it's not just how you kick the ball, it's where you kick it and why you kick it. And my view was that I had an ability to see things on the hoof to be able to change the shape of them. And now I'm just the running fly half, and Rob, who could also run the ball, you know, he wasn't a kicker, he's just the kicker, I'm the runner. I don't like the Manichean black and white to it.
Yes, or simplification. So across that 10 years, are you a frustrated onlooker too often to Rob Andrew?
Well, it's my fault. Yeah, I was very frustrated to the extent that twice I told England where to stop it. And that doesn't help with an international career when you're about 23 and you retire from international rugby. But Bath at that stage were a better, they played more exciting, better rugby than England, more interesting rugby. So I thought, well, when you're an amateur and you're on the bench and you're going up there for weekends doing training sessions, and then you see a game, it's absolutely dreadful. You know, when you get back with Bath, you'll be playing a more sophisticated brand of rugby after. I just thought, sod it. Why do I want to do this? And I quit. And I shouldn't have quit. I think there's that element of, I should have rolled up my sleeves and proved myself. I didn't. I'm better than him. And that was a mistake. And I did that twice. Mm. But it was a mistake. But it was also the right thing to do. Because it's only with hindsight I could say I shouldn't have done it. I was boiling up. I needed to release the steam. And I also, as an amateur rugby player, I had the God-given right just to say, I don't give a shit about playing for England. I said 10 minutes ago, I wasn't a nationalist, so Twickenham to me wasn't everything. Running out of the wreck in front of 10,000 meant more to me than running out in front of 60,000 at Twickenham, because I believe more in community. But to round this little segment up, Did I make a balls of my international career? Absolutely. And in the end, you know, it was the thought of a Lions tour that brought me back, made me play B rugby. And I had that sort of day against Scotland where it had all boiled down to you're either Andrew or Barnes. It was silly. And the day went my way. The next day in Ireland, I was man of the match again, but for Ireland, I played so bloody poorly. But it had all got very, very silly by that stage. But no, I didn't really help my cause at all. I can look back and say, yeah, perhaps I was a little bit hard done by, but probably the person who did the most damage to my international career was me.
And who were the people that you would have turned to for advice in that period? Is it family? Is it parents? Is it mates? Is it coaches?
No, I kept it. It was very hard. I kept things bottled up. When I spoke to my wife, I'd be ranting. Sometimes there would be, even in the Bath team, not much. I mean, I was very lucky in that I was having not liked Jerry Guscott, and Jerry Guscott not liking me when I joined. We became quite good friends. And it wouldn't be turning for advice, but I'd say we were in a training session at Bath, and I was completely comfortable in Bath. It was like my domain. So you just do everything. In a training session, I'd drop a goal 30 metres through the mud off my left foot, swagger around. Guscott would turn to me and say, pity you haven't got the balls to do that in the white shirt of England. You haven't got the nuts to do it. And I'd go home and I'd say to my wife, you can't believe what Guscott has just said to me. You know, and that, but, and there was a little tale as well in the last minute of a cup final, 60,000 at Twickenham, and Bath had always won every final. We were drawing with Harlequins, and we didn't like Harlequins, and a draw would have meant a tied tournament, and to us that was defeat. And I think there was 99 minutes on the clock at the last minute. I was absolutely shagged out. It's a hot day, not much oxygen left in the tank, and we had a line out, and we hadn't won one all day. And I said to Richard Hill, just call it quick off the top from now, get it into my hands. And I just turned to Phil de Glanville and Jerry Guscott and said, I'm going to bang this into the air, try and land it on the 22. If we win the ball, we get quick breakdown and we'll see if we can just split their defence that way. Guscott had his hands on his knees. He was standing outside centre. He shouted, if you haven't got the effing balls to go for a drop goal, chuck a miss one to me, Barnes. So I said, F you. And this was the degree of Bath sophistication. I said, F you, Jerry. The ball came to me. I took a long breath. I had time. Peter Winterbottom had run me into the ground, but he was knackered as well. And from just under 40 metres, I hit this low scudder, and it just went straight through the post. It wasn't pretty, but it was clean enough. It was no Sexton in Paris. And again, that was Guscott goading. And that's, I think, what I think a player always needs that. Someone to just say, go on, can you do that? But in England environment, you felt that was a challenge or a threat if it wasn't a mate. In Bath, it was how you lived your life. And I would hazard, well, I know it's how Saracens have operated, and I'd hazard a guess that Leinster possibly as well are driven by that sort of challenge.
for younger listeners, I mean, you can't overstate how successful and brilliant Bath were across the 80s and early 90s. You mentioned there Jack Rowell and Brian Ashton. There was a piece recently of Brian Ashton arriving in Ireland and hoping to bring a certain brand of rugby to the international side. And allegedly, apparently, after the first or second training session, I think he turned around and said, this ain't going to work. The skill set wasn't there. So give us a sense of Bath, the wreck. Gus Scott, I think we've got a glimpse of you in the midst of it all. This sounds like about as happy as your senior rugby career can get.
Yeah, happy, but not full of fun, because we were scared to death of losing. And that was another above from entitlement, which made you react badly to a setback. What the fear of failure did, it inhibited you sometimes. Like, we won all our finals in Bath, but I don't think, apart from one game against Gloucester, we didn't really perform. We made hard work of being teams we shouldn't do. And of course, the other thing for younger viewers, in those days, in September and the first part of October, we played on lovely tracks and we ran the ball, we had forwards, we kept it alive, and we handled well. And from April to mid-May, that was fine. The rest of the season, our ground was an absolute bog. So it was hard graft. But what was Bath? It was challenge. Challenge was the key word. You know, I spoke to Brian about Ireland, and I saw him close quarters when he became head coach of England in 2007 World Cup, and he couldn't get England to play the tunes he wanted because they played by numbers, and it was a real problem. Some players had the skill, but they wanted to be told what to do. My relationship with Brian was always confrontational. Jerry and myself would always say, you know, that's a crap move, it's not going to work. We try it, and we'd say no. Wouldn't be Brian saying that's what you do, and we would press him to think differently, and he would press up. I watched Mark Eller in 1984, my debut, and he stood absolutely flat, and I thought, I got to play like that. But I just couldn't. I didn't find a team environment until Ashton came to Bath in 87 or something. It was no one there to just force you onto the gain line. And we got closer and closer. And in training, I'd be saying to Brian, can we stop this? This is humiliating. Andy Robinson, our international flanker, who became a Lions coach and England coach, he'd just be batting the ball down all the time. But slowly but surely in training, just got a little bit quicker off the left and off the right. And we have a centre running on a wide arc, and outside centre drifting in, fullback cutting them. And it got to the stage where you were quick enough to beat your flanker. But then you had to say, right, which is the one? Where's the gap? And people said to me, oh, you've got a great vision for the game. You see things. And it wasn't vision. It was poor intellect. It was instinct. And it was the instinct of an incredible amount of training and working under pressure that no amateur teams in the Northern Hemisphere were being put under. And again, that's why I'd go with England and they'd say, like, you know, get 5 yards deeper. And we didn't want to be. I wanted Gary Guscott on an outside arc on the gain line, where the moment you realise he's drifted, it's good night, he's gone. Not 5 yards backwards, where a drift defence will just say, okay, and we'll just fan across. You know, an Ireland defence of now would have just watched him take the ball and go across and beat him. So Ashton challenged our skills and, more than anything, our ability to see space, I think, and understand it. But again, like with the ability to pick out the right one of three passes, that knowingness where and when and why to kick comes from being under pressure, not being told on a Monday morning. On a Monday evening at training, you wouldn't be told that was rubbish. There'd be, why did you do that, Stuart? Why did you do that, Chilcott? Why did you do that, Guscott? And we had to think for ourselves. And to me, rugby is a game of thought. I wrote a piece in the Times today about the breakdown. I think the breakdown is the essence of the game, because there are millions of decisions. Do I go in? Don't I? Do I roll away quickly? Do I just try and go a little bit further? All of those things make it very hard for rugby league players like Burgess and Andy Farrell to come in, while people like Jason Robinson found it easy wide. Because rugby union, every step you take, every decision you make has a consequence. Whereas rugby league, you can be a brilliant passer, you can be a 10-second sprinter, you can be strong as an ox. Sometimes you've just got the soft option of taking the tackle, roll the ball through the legs, you've got a set of six. So the brain aspect isn't there. And that's what I always loved about union, being encouraged to think. And Wales was a thinking rugby country. It had to be, because the Welsh race had a smaller population. They were not as big as Englishmen. So Wales didn't have as big forwards. So it had to say, how can we beat England? We'll be smart. And that's how Wales created this generation of brilliant backs. And there is an instinctiveness to Welsh back play, even in the bad times. But their pack was so poor that made you realise. That's why Wales and the Lions, they're back. Like, there's so many Welshmen there because they have this feel. And England didn't have that. Bath did have it. And that's when I felt comfortable as a rugby player, being right on the edge, being under pressure. And the satisfaction when you put someone into that gap was great.
That is a fascinating answer, I have to say. What was your job, by the way, on the Monday morning as an amateur?
I basically, after university, I just did any old job just to get enough dosh to play rugby, really. I was a useless conference organiser. I was a marketing manager for Wimpy Homes, so I went into the right-wing world of building. I was a marketing manager for a firm of accountants. I then became, my last job, I was a building society manager, where amazingly I passed the financial, all the financial exams. But I wasn't very good, because I used to tell people, if you get this mortgage that we can offer you, you and your future husband are going to have no money left for going out for a meal, going to the cinema, whatever you want to do, a week in Spain or something. So I said, are you sure you want to buy it? There wasn't much cop at it, really. And, you know, the game, I went professional as a writer the year before the game went professional. Because, frankly, the only thing I could do was write, talk and play rugby. And my body had cracked in terms of playing rugby. So I was left with two things. So I sort of halved my salary and I joined the Daily Telegraph. Again, that's right-wing institution. But they're the papers that love the rugby, and I've had a ball since. I haven't done a day's proper work in 35 years.
Well, I do want to finish up and ask you about the media career. Just as we talk here, because it's occurring to me now, what gave you this left-leaning, more liberal political grounding? What's the genesis of it, or the basis of it?
Troublesome, shitty little kid. My parents were, I wouldn't describe them as right-wingers, but they were traditional conservatives. Came very much from working-class background, got on a bit, so they thought the Tories were the party. I never did. And I was at a comprehensive school at the bottom of the Gwent Valleys. You know, the miners' strikes were lingering in the air. My instincts were always underdog anyway. And I think that didn't help England either, because English rugby very much likes to be the oppressor, and I like to be the sort of gorilla coming out from the jungle taking pot shots here and there. I think growing up in Wales was a part. Reading, I mean, if you read a lot as a kid, most of the writers I read had an inclination towards the left-wing inclinations. They were not nationalists. You know, you read James Joyce, you're not going to be a dyed-in-the-wool Tory. You can't. And, you know, everything I taught myself and everything about my background was of the left. And I think then I went to Oxford as a lefty. 3 years there turned me pretty hardcore. And I did join the Communist Party briefly, but I sort of saw through sort of discrepancies between what the Soviets thought was communism and what I thought was the right brand of socialism. And I'm still left.
You must be really enjoying politics over the last 4 years.
It's been a hard time to be an Englishman. It's desperate now. It's desperate now. The only consolation is that they're so poor that it doesn't, you know, you can't even say it's about being conservative. They're just so out of their depth that they're terrible. I mean, to me, though, what we had, we were 2 weeks late into the lockdown because we have a libertarian government that is so obsessed with economy, the extent of nothing else, that we were late and we got in trouble. And I wouldn't be surprised if we've come out a little bit early, despite the number of deaths, despite the death rate, because we're scared of the economy again. So it's one of those things. I reckon we were late in and we're early out, and that sums it up. But I get people saying to me, "Poor, imagine if Corbyn had been there, and if Jeremy Corbyn had been there." I don't think he was a very good politician. He made a load of errors, but Corbyn's very political instinct would have been to lock down very quickly. I mean, Tories, the phrase is nanny state. You know, they mocked the nanny state and they couldn't get into the nanny state when they needed it. And then it's been very difficult. Brexit is just a howling disaster, not because everything about Europe is perfect. I think Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, these countries have had a horrible time, and I think there's undoubtedly a sort of Northern European powerhouse split with the South. But what it raked up, the little Englander, the stuff we've been seeing at Churchill statues, people defending Churchill from defacement and using Nazi salutes. It's become quite ugly. It's become an excuse for people like Farage to stay in the spotlight. And there are times when you just think, stick your head in a book and listen to a bit of Bob Dylan and go away, but you can't.
Yeah.
You can't. You've got to know what's going on.
You retire in 94, TV happens not long thereafter. And I did not realize this until I had a look at sketches from memory, that you were actually presenting for a period in Italy. Asking Jeff Probyn about out half play, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's hard to imagine now. And I just think, as a broadcaster, I'm such a fan, particularly in those years where Sky had the Heineken Cup and you were on CoCom. It just worked. The whole thing kind of worked brilliantly. But by your own admission, you weren't the most naturally gifted frontman initially. A bit stilted, a bit monotone, maybe?
Listen, the problem was, nobody taught me that I had to just learn bullet points as a presenter. And we would have 45 minutes on air pre, half an hour off. And it was almost as if I was trying to audition for the Royal Shakespeare Company. I learned every link. I wrote these long, convoluted links, very literary links, because I wanted to prove, now I'd hung my boots up, how clever I was.
Yeah.
And you get the first one off, and then you're thinking, shit, now where am I going? And you know, you'd even come up with a Eric Mahn quote to go to an ad break. It was just stupid. And I found it very difficult as well, as you say, to talk to a prop forward or a referee, because in those first years, nobody knew what Sky was, let alone who it was. So when they said, "Do you want to be a guest?" they're going, "What?" We probably paid about 50 quid. And so we had this huge build-up and this long, long sort of exit out of the programme. So I was stilted, but I was stilted because I was soliloquizing sort of great rafts of Barnes rhetoric in my head. I wasn't good enough to do it. I needed someone to just say, "Hey, welcome to Sky. It's going to be a great game." I could do it now. I couldn't then.
Yes.
But I wasn't suited for that because, you know, I was an opinionated former fly half, like being captain because I like being boss. I was better off just sort of being, as I said a few minutes ago, the gorilla in the jungle who comes in with a snipe here and there and an observation. tradition, and I loved that. And those first years, you know, the early years of the Heineken Cup were spectacular. And I would say this, I loved the fact that throughout my career at Sky, we, until the last few years, didn't do what a lot of other broadcasters did and say, if it's England v Ireland, we must have England, we must have Ireland. We didn't give a damn. And I was very proud of that, because everybody in our organisation, and I think a lot of people in rugby, understood that I couldn't give a damn if Munster were playing Wasps or even Munster were playing Bath. I'd just call a game. It was an international, you know, absolutely the same. And I don't like any form of broadcasting where there has to be something, a concession to nationalism, and that you can't accept that the broadcasters, if they're good enough and they're professional, would call a game. I mean, if you just want to get some bozo who stopped playing football to talk, it may be. But if you've got professionals doing it, you don't have to have every nation under the sun represented. Commentary is not a United Nations.
I must say, even over here, where we might be more acutely sensitive to it all, I'd never felt that it was, you know, far from even just a sneaking regard for Munster. I felt you and Sky were fully on the bandwagon and fully recognised there was something a bit special happening during those years. You know, I never got the sense that it was, well, English v Irish. I thought you were very on board with Munster in particular. I have two last questions. The vagaries of TV rights and the future of media. I mean, I'm sure you would love it for the next 20 years. Sky kept doing the Heineken Cup and they hadn't gone and messed with the format, which kind of worked and destabilized that tournament. And I think that the tournament has lost something. That is just the reality. That's certainly the feeling over here. So does that put you under pressure? Are you eagerly watching who gets the next batch of rights? Are you
no, because I've quit. I've Sky and myself have parted a while ago.
I didn't realise that.
Well, that's because we've got no rights to anything at the moment. I stayed on for the last set of autumn internationals that where England had rights, so 2018, and saw the season out. But my decision was, it didn't help me as a writer not being able to cover live games, because I was doing Bedford v Coventry, second tier championship matches, you know, and I didn't know whether Sky would get right back. And also I would say, having been a live broadcaster for 25 years, there does come a time when you think, what more have I got to say live about the game in a fresh way? And I didn't want to get into this habit of, I know a lot of ex-players, they come up with, it's like reading the Bible in Latin. Makes people think you know what you're on about, you know? It's a sort of a Catholic thing, being able to use the changing room talk. If you get older, you're further away from it anyway. But I loathe all that cliche crap. So it became very hard. And I think it is probably a younger man's game, in the sense also that broadcasting has got far more... It tilts towards, let's make it entertaining. I didn't look like this. I tried to broadcast as I played the game with a peripheral vision. I tried to look at the big picture, not the small picture. And it has changed a little bit. And there's no doubt, if you said to me, throughout my career, I always preferred writing to talking. And there did come a time when, you know, on a Monday, you think, right, I better review that game, see what I commentated like. And you think, oh, shit, it's that voice again. Is that really me? So I made the decision that it would be the right thing to get out on the top. And the other, you know, from Sky's point of view, I'd been there a long time. I was on a reasonably decent salary to commentate on games that two men and a dog were watching. So it didn't really work for any of us. And I'm very happy now to be very much on the written side. So to answer your question, it's not difficult for me.
Right.
Yes, something has been lost. And I'm not going to say it's because Sky have lost it. I would say it's because European rugby is better served by one broadcaster. I think when you're scrambling around to work out who's doing what when, at fixing schedules, it doesn't work as well. I think a lot of people have been very kind in Ireland and they've talked about the Sky years, but we as broadcasters, it's always about what happened on the pitch. I always said to young players coming through, you're not the story, never think you are. Doesn't mean many of them take much notice. We're attendance, centre stage are the players. And so I was very lucky. One of the reasons I think Sky was quite popular in Ireland, in those early years, that Munster story was such an irrepressible, exciting story. And we were the ones telling the European tale after a couple of years of the BBC. And we were there when they lifted up the trophy and, Miles was blabbing his eyes out in Cardiff against Toulouse. You could not get roped into the story. And I'm sure if BT had been where we were at that stage, I'm sure Lawrence Dallaglio even would have had his heart would have gone out to Munster and would have been willing them on. The ex-player understood that empathy and tight-knittedness of team and community. And I didn't like the way they played most of the time, but there was something special there. And that's why in my heart, much though I prefer watching Leinster play, if I stopped playing rugby and I moved to Ireland and I had to take one of those teams, I'd be a Munster man. I apologise to all my friends in Leinster, but that is sort of the essence of who I am. I'm more Munster than Dublin.
Last question then. You were on Keith Wood's State of the Union recently on this show, and so you've talked about the game in broad terms, off the pitch very much as much as on the pitch. I'm just curious, though, for your on-pitch perspective for a moment. You talk about the English attitude and thinking around the game when you were playing. In 2020, say, take Six Nations as a barometer of the teams we see, or even the World Cup recently, do you like the way the game is being played in the main?
No, I don't. I don't like it because I think code control is too great and rugby is not American football. You can't stop and start. And I think that's one of the reasons we've got into this horrendous world of the pick and drive grind, millimetre, flop over the ball. Leinster are very good at it. Exeter have turned it into an art form, but it's a horrible art form. The era of 30, 40 phases, I don't care what commentators, how good they think it is tedious. You can only have 40 phases because you're going over the top and you're protecting the ball and it just makes it very dull. I think Ireland, Joe was a breathless, brilliant coach at Leinster. I think the balance in the early years, Ireland was very good. He just became a coach by numbers. And I think Ireland has still got to break out of that. I don't blame South Africa. I have every respect for how they won the World Cup because they had a brilliant vision of how to use a mighty double front five. They had halfbacks who kicked well. They set their defensive pattern. No problem with how you play the game, but it was limited. And always you think in the end, if New Zealand are not raising the bar, no one else is taking it there. And World Cups at the moment are not won by teams going above New Zealand. They're won by New Zealand. Maybe, fair dues, England were brilliant that day, but New Zealand come down. I felt before the World Cup, their knickers in a twist between having two open sides when they always 7-8. I felt the Barrett thing, and I still feel the Barrett thing, they're getting it wrong. It should be fly half. In the end, they were found out against, you've got your best player, you don't shove him full back where he could be isolated. So I felt New Zealand just lacked that clarity. And without that clarity, they were vulnerable. But I want one day a team to beat New Zealand when New Zealand are brilliant. I remember one England coach said to me, he was a coach in 2003, and he said, I don't think the game has gone forward much from when I was coach. Now, you could say, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? But I look at the England teams in those 17 years, and England's Total Rugby around the turn of the century under Woodward, Ashton, Dave Allred's kicking drills. England were a magnificently varied team. And I don't know if there has been a better England team. And if in the first years of professionalism, 20 years on, England can't produce a better team than the one that won the World Cup, then there's an issue. And I think that Eddie Jones addressed that. The game has got bogged down. It has become not too physical, because it has to be physical to make space. It's got slow, it's got bogged down, and it's lost its intellect. And that's why I hope to God that the referees stick with the breakdown and they ping the life out of the opposing teams as they did this weekend in New Zealand, and we get some oxygen coming out of the breakdown. If we get slow breakdown ball, you get pick and drive, you get kill it. That has to end. If that ends, then I think the game will flow again. But I think it's not the change in the laws, it's the interpretation has damaged the game desperately.
Listen, that was such a pleasure. And it's no slight on your writing, which is fantastic. But I hope we see you back doing a bit of broadcasting as well soon, one way or another down the line. Stuart Barnes, what a pleasure. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Joe. Thank you very much.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.